the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Dr. Paul Dunscombe, professor of East Asian history at UAA, speaks on Whatever Happened to Japan, the economic superpower that never was. An East Asian scholar with graduate degrees from the State University of New York at Albany and the University of Kansas, Dr. Dunscombe specializes in modern Japanese history, focusing on the domestic political aspects of the Japanese intervention and occupation of Siberia, 1918 to 1922. His book manuscript on this topic, the first ever complete narrative of Japan's Siberian intervention in English or Japanese, is currently under consideration by the University of Hawaii Press. Dr. Dunscombe is the recipient of the Fulbright Research Fellowship for Study in Japan and co-recipient of the Fulbright Hayes Group Projects Abroad grant to lead a study tour of the Russian Far East. Professor Dunscombe teaches East Asian civilization, modern China, modern Japan, as well as specialty courses in the evolution of the samurai and the history of the Chinese Communist Party at the University of Alaska Anchorage. On Friday, May 15th, he spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on Whatever Happened to Japan, the economic superpower that never was. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Professor of East Asian History at UAA, Dr. Paul Dunscombe.
Sadly, the recent end of the semester makes it impossible for me to assign myself as extra credit, but we shall carry on regardless. Good afternoon. Thanks very much, Ted, for that most flattering introduction. Thanks also for your service on the board of the Alaska World Affairs Council, which comes to an end this year after 6 years of fine service. While I'm at it, thanks to Rod Finkel for his service as president of the World Affairs Council over the past year and his willingness to continue in that capacity for next year. And thanks especially to Lisa Falsko, who presented me with the challenge to either find a speaker for this date or be the speaker. And certainly my thanks to very much to all of you for coming out on this admittedly necessary, but I seem to think entirely unforecasted rainy day. When it began to appear that I would in fact end up as the speaker for this session, I naturally began to wonder what I might talk about. You've heard me here more than once before talking about various subjects regarding East Asia and the Russian Far East. As Ted mentioned in his introduction, I am the director of the UAA Confucius Institute, and now that it is beginning to emerge somewhat from its larval state and should be a genuinely going concern by the end of this summer, one of my first thoughts was to talk about that and what it can do. And I'll be happy to do that for you some other time, but not today. For it occurred to me that, damn it, I'm a Japan specialist. I am a Japan specialist both by training and inclination. My relationship with Japan is complex and deep and of long standing. Yet in all the time I've been here, and all the times I've appeared before you to introduce speakers to talk about Japan, cast your mind back to last week, for instance, I myself have never had the opportunity to talk with you exclusively about Japan, and I would like to rectify that situation today. Having resolved to speak about Japan, I was then presented with the dilemma of what exactly should I say about it? At first, the thought occurred that I could talk about some of my recent research. Without quite realizing it, I have amassed a body of work over the last several years that adds up to a quite thorough examination of lost decade Japan. As Ted mentioned, I could talk about what the crisis in Japanese professional baseball in 2004 and subsequently tells us about the potential for successful mass action and the prospects for meaningful political change there. Or I could describe for you some of my, well, let's just call them esoteric projects, like trying to explain why there is no Japanese Batman. Or attempting to understand why is it, with all due deference to the new Terminator movie opening next week, that should the day ever come that machines enslave the human race, they are likely to take the form of Hello Kitty robots. Ultimately, it struck me that these might not be the most appropriate topics for a World Affairs Council audience. However, I would be happy to address those questions in the Q&A if you're curious. My next thought was to try and find some way to convince you that despite the rise of China, Japan was still relevant. That the world's second largest economy, with the second highest GDP per capita, a financial and industrial giant, and also with the fourth largest defense establishment on the planet, was important to our future. What hope could we have of navigating our way out of the present global economic morass without Japan's leadership, I hoped to argue. That thought lasted a couple of seconds, really, and then it went away. For the fact is, when we contemplate how to extract ourselves from the consequences of our own bubble and to free our surviving banks and financial institutions from their own toxic assets, the same sorts of challenges which Japan faced as their bubble economy imploded, Japan serves as a model of what not to do and an object lesson in the perils that await us should we fail to act otherwise. And indeed, the most notable thing about Japan over the course of the present global recession, in fact, throughout this decade, has been its near invisibility. As large as the Japanese economy is, as important as Japan is as a holder of U.S. reserve currency and investor in U.S. Treasury notes, as important a presence as Japanese banks and corporations are in the global economy, the most notable thing that any Japanese economic official has done to draw attention to Japan in the last few months was when Nakagawa Shoichi, the finance minister, appeared to deliver a rambling, drunken press statement at the G7 summit in Rome last February, the continuous replay of which on YouTube rapidly forced his resignation. And with all due respect to Professor Joseph Ha, who spoke here 3 weeks ago, while Japan certainly has been forthcoming with financial aid for the IMF and has done all that has been asked of it to meet the current global financial crisis, this is not the same thing as providing global leadership. Japanese officials have not been brooding about their desire to perhaps find a replacement for the dollar as a global reserve currency. Japanese officials have not made known their unease over the utility of U.S. Treasury notes as a long-term store of value. China has. Indeed, the actions Japan has taken, I would say, stem primarily out of a sense of giri, that is, duty or obligation, and also the realization that economic recovery for Japan can only take place in a global context. The idea that the true engine of economic growth in Japan is exports, and therefore Japan absolutely requires a healthy, functioning global economy, has been firmly nailed to the mast for over six decades. And that's where I began to figure out what it was that I wanted to talk to you about with you today. I was confirmed in this by a recent vigorous wallow in nostalgia. Some weeks ago, I was poking about through the display of books that our library puts out periodically, of volumes being retired from circulation. These books can be yours at prices ranging from a dollar to absolutely free, and our most grateful thanks for carrying them out with you. In poking through the available titles, I was first struck by the fact that, all due respect to my dear political science colleague Diddy Hitchens, nothing goes quite so stale as old social science texts. But right behind them are 20-year-old works describing global perils to America's futures. Among these works, I found a copy of Clyde Prestwitt's 1988 book, Trading Places, How We Are Giving Our Future to Japan and How to Reclaim It. Prestwitz had been a key Commerce Department official during the Reagan administration, whose brief was Japan. He was one of a phalanx of Commerce and State Department officials who had worked diligently to try and correct the growing trade imbalances, which had caused such friction in U.S.-Japanese relations from the mid-1970s. At the time, this was an influential work. It was considered to be important and authoritative and containing a vital message. Now, the library would be very happy if I would carry it off at no charge. Prestwitz was what used to be called in the good old days a Japan basher. He was part of a cadre of journalists, businessmen, former government officials, and academics, folks like Carl von Wolferen, Ezra Vogel, Chalmers Johnson, etc., who argued that despite the supposed legacies of the U.S. occupation, Japanese continued to practice politics and economics according to Japanese principles and for Japanese ends. They also noted that many of these practices were inimical to long-term American interests, and if we didn't want to have the Japanese eating our lunch quite soon, we had better wise up and do something about it, like perhaps even adopting some of these Japanese practices for corporate management or government-industry cooperation. Basically, all the things that we now say or very soon will be saying about China. So to bring my rather long introduction to a point, I want to talk to you today about how that 20-year-old future, the rise of Japan, Japan as number one, failed to happen. First, though, it's necessary to step back. One of the key aspects of modern Japanese history is that from the moment the Japanese people embarked upon the project of modernity, it was never enough to simply be run-of-the-mill modern. Instead, it was necessary for Japan to be modern as the leading nations of the day were modern. And this meant that from the very beginning, it was necessary for Japan to catch up, to make up lost ground, to close the distance between itself and the leading powers of the day. And one can see this idea expressed as early as 1854, when the Tokugawa shogunate was contemplating what to do about Commodore Perry. E. Naosuke, a high shogunal official, noted that while Japan was clearly behind Americans and other Westerners in things like steam navigation and other technology, he was also aware that their status as advanced practice states was a comparatively recent development. Therefore, he said, I do not see how the people of our country, who are clever and quick-witted, should prove inferior to Westerners if we begin training at once, unquote. Not only have Japanese historically resolved to practice modernity at a high level, but on two occasions they have settled upon an extraordinarily broad consensus about what would be the key measure of modernity. From the 1870s to 1945, the ne plus ultra of Japanese modernity was the possession of an overseas empire. Possession of an empire and the ability to spread civilization through it would give ultimate proof that Japan had mastered modernity. Indeed, one of the reasons why I study the Siberian intervention is because it throws a bright light on the existential crisis the Japanese suffered in the immediate aftermath of World War I, when it appeared that the key element of modernity might instead be democratic constitutional politics and a commitment to Wilsonian internationalism rather than empire. Obviously, the experience of defeat and occupation put paid the notion of modernity through empire, but it wasn't until 1960 that the choice was made to pursue a new consensus, one which took as its basic premise that the ultimate measure of modernity was international economic power. The goal became to pursue national economic development with the final objective of making Japan an economic superpower. Here, too, the goal would be to catch up, to make up lost ground, to make Japan number one, if not in total GDP, then certainly in per capita GDP. Yet pursuit of the goal of making Japan a Keizai Taikoku, an economic superpower, eventually presented the Japanese with precisely the same dilemma of a dog chasing a car. Okay, I've caught it. Now what do I do with it? The post-war consensus started with a basic agreement on possibly the most contentious issue of the 1950s, which was defense policy. After 1960, it was broadly agreed that Article 9 of the American-authored Peace Constitution, which forswore the maintenance of armed forces and the right to wage war, would not be amended, but neither would it be rigorously enforced, meaning that Japan's substantial self-defense forces would operate, as they continue to do to this day, in a constitutional gray zone. Japan would also pursue an exclusively defensive defense, confined solely to the home islands, and Japan would observe the so-called three non-nuclear principles. Japan would not develop, nor come to possess nuclear weapons, nor permit them to be stored on its soil. Finally, Japan's basic defense budget would be fixed at 1% of GDP. The key elements of the post-war consensus, however, were economic and could be seen most clearly through the so-called income doubling plan of 1960, which set the goal of doubling Japan's gross domestic product by the end of the decade. A troika of industry, the bureaucratic politicians of the Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, and government bureaucrats, mostly centered in the key Ministry of International Trade and Industry, MITI, and the Ministry of Finance, would spur and guide economic development primarily by fostering exports. At the same time, they would spread the wealth of economic development by encouraging the growth of so-called new industrial cities and other modernization projects in areas of the country largely untouched by industrialization up to that time. Though primarily the idea of those within the highest echelons of the bureaucracy, industry, and the LDP, this new post-war consensus achieved widespread approval because it delivered the goods: social peace, prosperity, and the creation of a democratic egalitarian ethos, which led Japanese, for at least the last quarter of the 20th century, to consistently and overwhelmingly identify themselves as middle class. And indeed, Japan routinely featured some of the lowest income disparities among developed nations. Pursuit of such policies rapidly achieved global recognition of Japanese economic power. Japan quickly gained entry into the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. International trade and financial institutions like the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, the ancestor to the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And the ultimate sign of having made it into the ranks of leading world economic powers, Japan was a founding member of the G7, the group of seven leading industrial nations. The new consensus also delivered to the Japanese something more ephemeral, but I believe equally important. It made Japan an exemplar of modernity. Actually, Japan, especially the streets of urban Japan, ultimately became the cockpit of a sort of hyper-modernity. This was exemplified in the realm of technology, everything from bullet trains to microelectronics, but also in the realm of culture. If someone wished to peek 20 minutes into the future, the thing to do was to wander such trendy Tokyo neighborhoods as Roppongi or Shinjuku or Shibuya. To see a thoroughly modern people, enjoying the benefits of cutting-edge modern technology, living amidst groundbreaking modern architecture and design, one needed to see Japan. However, this vision was, as modernity always has been, often a little scary. It's not for nothing that Ridley Scott's classic film Blade Runner, or the cyberpunk novels of William Gibson and others, borrowed their rather dystopic settings from contemporary Tokyo. And even the Japanese could find living in such hyper-modernity unsettling, as Otomo Katsuhiro's groundbreaking 1988 anime film Akira suggests. And, of course, this new Japan did in fact come with a quite genuine dark side. For while Japan's success during the miracle years was undeniable, it was bought at a heavy opportunity cost both by foreign nations who served as Japan's principal markets and by the Japanese themselves. For the pursuit of the new consensus required the government to favor industry over local populations, most notably in matters pertaining to industrial pollution, producers over consumers, requiring Japanese to purchase more expensive goods at home to subsidize selling them more cheaply abroad to gain market share, and small business and farmers over larger retailers, basically institutionalizing gross inefficiencies in Japan's domestic economy to protect the interests of key LDP constituencies. What's worse, the commitment of the government to spread the benefits of economic development evenly throughout the nation in time came almost exclusively to take the form of pork barrel projects doled out by the Ministry of Construction and other government agencies. These produced projects which turned out to be environmentally harmful, so shore stabilization projects which actually encouraged erosion or destroyed wetlands and channeling rivers in ways that actually made flooding worse, or slathering concrete indiscriminately upon the hills and mountains of the countryside. Or these produced projects that provided nothing of actual value, and indeed Japan could teach us a thing or two about roads and bridges to nowhere. Or it created monstrous vanity projects like airports without traffic or exhibition and concert halls that stand empty. Moreover, this newfound economic power was built upon the so-called dual economy. That is, the world-class industrial enterprises of Japan, offering the benefits of the so-called Japanese employment system, lifetime employment, seniority wages, and all the other benefits of the salaryman lifestyle, rested upon a foundation of small subcontractors who lacked any of these benefits and were compelled to absorb the pain of economic downturns so that Japan's salarymen could continue to enjoy the benefits of the system. Even so, by the late 1980s, the height of the bubble economy, the belief had become nearly universal that Japan had what seemed to be the best of both worlds. It had the dynamism of capitalism, but without the chaos that can result from unchecked competition. It had the efficiency and unity of purpose of a centralized industrial system, but lacked the tendency to stagnation of communist command economies. Following this model, Japan seemed poised to become the leader of global capitalism. Japanese banks were growing into the world's largest. Japanese corporations, flush with cash, were indiscriminately buying American companies in real estate, most famously Rockefeller Center in New York. Japan was financing the deficit spending of the Reagan years. Japanese manufacturers were universally acknowledged as world-class, and managers and corporate officers were racing to teach themselves about Japanese just-in-time delivery inventory systems and the secrets of total quality management. It was all this, plus the fact that at the height of the bubble, by 1989, all of the land in metropolitan Tokyo was theoretically worth more than all the land in the United States. The Imperial Palace grounds themselves were theoretically worth more than the state of California. All of this that gave Clyde Prestowitz and his fellow Japan bashers their sense of urgency, as well as their ready audience. But Japan's moment of triumph, when it appeared poised to lead the world economically, was in fact shockingly brief and seemed in many ways terribly disorienting for Japan, especially its leadership. Japan had evolved a political economy that was well-structured to promote development and to deliver the necessary elements of the post-war consensus, but sadly ill-equipped to manage a mature economy, and even less well-equipped to provide global leadership, especially in an international environment of rapid change. By an historical accident, the change in Japan's fortunes coincided with the death of Emperor Hirohito and the accession of his son, Akihito, in January of 1989. For those of you not aware of this, I should point out that today is not May 16th, 2009 in Japan. It is the 16th day of the fifth month of the 20th year of the reign of the Heisei Emperor. And just as the three previous modern imperial eras have had a character of their own, so too the Heisei era has two major underlying themes running through it, which I believe to be intimately related. The first theme is that the world which Japan inhabited for much of the post-war period, the global context in which the post-war consensus was able to operate, began to change very rapidly in a number of fundamental ways at the beginning of the Heisei period, and it continues stubbornly to do so. The Japanese appear to be having a very hard time trying to keep up with these changes. This contributes to the second major theme of the Heisei period, an inability to come to a new consensus about what Japan ought to be and what it needs to do to fit itself into this rapidly changing world. Not that this was immediately obvious. Indeed, the very drama of the events taking place early in the Heisei period, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Gulf War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, tended to obscure exactly how bad things had gotten. Certainly no one saw a systemic crisis on the horizon for Japan. The elder George Bush's trip to Japan in 1992, which you may remember was most notable for him vomiting in the lap of the Japanese prime minister at dinner, was very much one of the U.S. going cap in hand. U.S.-Japan trade friction even occupied the minds of the Clinton administration in its first couple of years before the whole idea seemed pointless. In any event, by the time the movie of Michael Crichton's controversial 1990 book Rising Sun came out in 1995, the party was already well and truly over. By that time, Japan was well embarked on the deep, entrenched, systemic, economic, political, and social crisis which eventually came to be called the Lost Decade. The Lost Decade, which lasted from at least 1992 through 2003, in many respects represents the long death agony of the post-war consensus. And indeed, what made the crisis so prolonged was the ultimately futile attempt of those particularly advantaged under the old system, LDP politicians, bureaucrats, and industry, to try and ride out the storm, making the absolute minimum change necessary to survive until business as usual could resume. The first to feel the pinch was the LDP. In the spring of 1993, through an unforeseeable congeries of events, the LDP was actually thrown out of office for the first time in 38 years. The first event was a corruption scandal surrounding illegal stock trading so gross that even a Japanese electorate long inured to such scandals choked on it. While much of the rest of Japan had lost its shirt in the stock market, all of the major securities firms in Japan were proved to be making up losses sustained by LDP politicians. The scandal helped to lay bare the extent to which bribery was endemic to LDP rule. This disillusion with the LDP was accompanied by a shift in attitudes towards the traditional opposition, Japan's Socialist Party. With the end of the Cold War and the fall of communism, the JSP renamed itself the Social Democratic Party, SDP, and many of the positions it had taken in opposition to the LDP on ideological grounds, which had frankly made it unelectable up through the 1980s, were quietly shelved, if not outright abandoned. Additionally, there arose a number of more centrist opposition parties, many of which calved off from the old LDP. And while some of these parties were formed out of principle and others formed out of naked ambition, the reliable two-thirds majority the LDP traditionally counted on in parliament suddenly dissolved, allowing a coalition government of opposition parties to displace the LDP. This interregnum in LDP power was not especially long, lasting less than a year. But in that time, the opposition was able to pass electoral reform laws which managed to alter the Japanese political landscape in important ways. Most especially the proportional representation system, which had created a gross imbalance between rural and urban voters, was significantly modified. Perhaps Professor Hitchens can explain this, but under the old system, a reliable rural LDP vote could often be four times as powerful as an urban vote. Now the balance of the system was shifted towards urban voters. Now, of course, those of you keeping up with Japanese politics will note that the LDP remains in power today. They managed to return to power via the back door, entering into a coalition government with another party in 1994. That the LDP might join a coalition in order to regain power was not terribly surprising. What made this development truly shocking was the coalition partner which the LDP found. The Social Democrats, the renamed version of the old JSP, the people who had denounced the LDP as illegitimate and had opposed them on almost every issue on principle for nearly 40 years, joined the LDP in forming a new government. In my mind, this qualifies as the most cynical deal in the history of Japanese politics, which is famous for its cynical deal-making. Basically, the Social Democrats gave the LDP the keys to the kingdom in return for the opportunity for its aging leadership to enjoy a victory lap in office before retirement. Incidentally, the SDP was eventually severely punished for this. In the first election after this deal, they dropped from about 130 seats to 70. In the next election after that, they dropped from 70 to 40. And today, the SDP can only boast about six legislators. So one of the most significant and ironic results of this political shift was the collapse of the left in Japan. The bureaucracy was the next member of the all-important triad to suffer a severe blow. In 1997, just as Japan was absorbing the impact of the Asian financial panic, it was revealed that senior members of the Ministry of Finance had long been receiving gifts and bribes from banks and securities firms that they were supposed to be regulating. Now, I am sure there are a number of you here who are not at all happy with the supposedly incestuous relationship between Wall Street firms and the SEC, but Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and AIG never had offices whose primary duty was taking out senior SEC officials to expensive cocktail bars and strip clubs. The result of the scandal was to shake the confidence of the Japanese people in the integrity of the bureaucracy. It was part of the function of party politicians to be corrupt in this way, but so-called career bureaucrats were supposed to mitigate that by being selfless servants of the state. The end of that confidence led to the erosion of the bureaucracy's vitally important leadership function in laying out the basic course of Japan's development. This would make it possible for a particularly ambitious politician to seize the mantle of leadership. Another result of the scandal was to considerably loosen the symbiotic relationship between government and industry, especially in the financial sector. Bureaucrats from MITI and the Ministry of Finance had shielded Japan's major banks and securities firms from the collapse of the bubble economy in 1989, but could no longer do so in 1997 and 1998, which led to one of Japan's four major securities firms and several banks going belly up. In the wake of this, the parliament pushed through legislation reorganizing financial oversight organizations in an effort to induce some degree of transparency, openness, and a greater effectiveness in actually dealing with the consequences of Japan's financial crisis rather than merely papering over the cracks. Nor did Japanese industry prove immune to the effects of the lost decade. A number of domestic industries were very hard hit by the crisis of 1997-98, but Japan's world-leading industrial manufacturers, Toyota, Nissan, Sony, Honda, and others, were also forced to take steps to defend themselves, including either moving significant portions of management and production overseas, as Sony and Honda had done, or taking on foreign partners. Nissan was not only forced to sell a majority stake to Renault, but had to take on a foreign CEO. The double hit of the bubble economy and the Asian financial panic ultimately proved too much for Japan's dual economy to absorb. This forced Japanese companies to abandon the basic elements of the Japanese employment system. While few corporations resorted to direct layoffs, corporate restructuring was especially hard on middle management, who were either forced into early retirement or saw their divisions divested from the corporate parent to sink or swim, mostly sink, on their own. The hiring of young university students, graduates, was also radically scaled back, meaning fewer and fewer Japanese who had endured examination hell to get themselves on the corporate fast track found they had nowhere to go, or more and more Japanese found they had nowhere to go upon graduation. So at the start of the new millennium, with the bureaucracy undermined by scandal, the LDP estranged from their traditional constituencies by political reform, and Japanese industry breaking the social contract of the Japanese employment system due to continuing economic crisis, it proved quite easy for Koizumi Junichiro, a maverick politician who became prime minister in 2001, to uproot the last vestiges of the post-war consensus and to try and impose a new vision. This one based upon a notion of Japan as a normal country, ready to do what was necessary to deal with its manifold problems, able to conduct itself in foreign and defense policy as any other country might, and to justly claim that which a nation of Japan's stature was entitled to. Initiatives were taken to reform Japan's domestic economy and end its addiction to government pork, which, among other things, had run up the national debt to nearly 150% of Japan's GDP. Certainly the most significant of Koizumi's domestic reforms was his effort to privatize the postal system, especially the postal savings system, whose trillions of yen in savings had long been used as an LDP slush fund. This proposal brought forth such opposition from the old stalwarts of the LDP that Koizumi did something in September 2005 which no Japanese politician had ever done before. He dissolved parliament and called a general election, asking the Japanese people for a mandate to pursue his policies. He also drove the rebels out of the party and brought in large numbers of younger women candidates to replace them. And he was returned with a staggering majority, which still exists today. In many respects, however, the most profound change Koizumi wrought was to challenge all of the basic underpinnings of the consensus on Japanese defense policy. The notion that Japan should pursue an exclusively defensive defense had already been undercut by the experience of the Gulf War. The idea that Japan's major contribution to the U.S.-led coalition was simply monetary sat poorly both at home and abroad. In order to appear to be shouldering more of the burden, Japan dispatched a naval force to assist with logistics and minesweeping after the war was concluded. Subsequently, laws were changed, which made it possible for Japanese troops to take part in UN peacekeeping operations, most notably in Cambodia in 1992. Under Koizumi's aegis, however, this effort ramped up considerably, and Japan became what some have described as America's deputy sheriff, committing itself to assist the U.S. in maintaining the security of East Asia and the Western Pacific. Most importantly, Koizumi was responsible for the dispatch of a small but highly significant and symbolic contingent of Japanese ground forces to Iraq. Additionally, during the Koizumi years, the basic Japanese defense budget climbed to 2% of GDP. The ongoing North Korean nuclear crisis has prompted discussion about the abandonment of the three non-nuclear principles, so far only discussion. Steps were taken to elevate the defense agency to a fully-fledged ministry, which it became not long after Koizumi left office. And the first serious discussions of amending Article 9 of the peace constitution since the 1950s sprang up during his watch. In September 2006, term limits on LDP party leadership forced Koizumi to resign as prime minister. Since that time, a reaction seems to have set in against much of the Koizumi program. The LDP has proved uncomfortable with Koizumi's dynamic, maverick style of governance, but has proved utterly incapable of providing competent leadership to replace it. Japan has had three prime ministers since Koizumi resigned, none of whom has lasted more than a year in office, and each of which has managed to achieve popular approval ratings in the near the single digits. This appears to have left the way open for the Japan Democratic Party, the newly arisen opposition party, to succeed in national elections, which must take place before September 10th of this year. The Democratic Party handed the LDP a truly thumping defeat in upper house elections 2 years ago, and if they are able to take control of the all-powerful lower house, Japan will have a secure non-LDP government for the first time really since 1947. Turning out the LDP would be a monumental development for Japanese politics. This despite the fact that no one in Japan is particularly sure that the politicians of the Democratic Party are any more capable of ruling Japan than the politicians of the LDP. And indeed, the distinct possibility that the new boss might prove same as the old boss was highlighted just this week when Ozawa Ichiro, leader of the Democratic Party, and one of the more interesting political figures in post-war Japan, was forced to resign as the result of a campaign finance scandal where an aide was caught taking illegal contributions from a construction company. Still, the disgust of the Japanese people with the LDP makes it likely that they will be thrown out. And it is notable that at this supposedly rough time for the opposition, the LDP has so far steadfastly declined to call for new elections. But in many respects, I have yet to address the most fundamental question, which is, what do the Japanese people make of all this? What have they been left with after the death of the post-war consensus? Prime Minister Koizumi may have had his problematic aspects, but under his rule, the lost decade did end. Economic growth, steady if unspectacular, did return, and some degree of normalcy did appear to be reasserting itself. And yet, even before the current recession hit, the Japanese were beginning to voice their discontent. One final casualty of Koizumi's assault on the post-war consensus was the end of that democratic egalitarian ethos that I spoke of. With the cutting back of aid to Japan's rural regions and the hardships that economic reforms have wrought, Japanese had already become aware of the fact that the new economy featured winners and losers. A large portion, nearly a quarter, of the Japanese people found themselves with no savings to fall back on. And the old Japanese employment system is but a shadow of its former self, with many of the people finding jobs doing so as temporary workers without benefits. And many Japanese were very conscious of the fact that they were among the losers in this new economy. Now add to that the worst recession in Japan since the late 1940s, the collapse of Japan's export economy falling by over a half from a year ago, which has caused Japan to endure its first trade deficit since 1980. The heavy losses throughout the Japanese economy have caused an acceleration of the shift of production overseas and the ready resort to layoffs by hard-hit companies. The situation is bad. And even though, like us, the worst may be over, there is no guarantee that things will return to normal anytime soon. There's a lot more I could say, but perhaps we'll just conclude and go on to the Q&A. In many respects, the post-war consensus on building Japanese economic power succeeded beyond anyone's expectations. But dealing with the consequences of success on those terms has proved to be a daunting challenge. Perhaps its greatest success was also its greatest weakness. Japan was made thoroughly modern and prosperous, but the social peace and the egalitarian ethos it inspired ultimately convinced many, both inside and outside Japan, that passivity and conformity were the Japanese people's natural state. Yet as an historian of Japan, I can tell you that the Japanese have never lacked for social dynamism, never wanted a capacity for self-assertion, and have proved eminently capable of demanding what they perceive to be rightfully theirs. Today's Japanese, who have come to be associated with a passive acquiescence to LDP bureaucratic rule, are starting to grow bitter, angry, and frustrated. Someone once said that when economic grievances become political grievances, the result is revolution. Japan might not be on the verge of revolution exactly, but the grievances of the Japanese people are mounting, and their patience is growing thin. Attention should be paid. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Alaska World Affairs Council Presents, Dr. Paul Dunscombe, Professor of East Asian History at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He was recorded speaking at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on Friday, May 15th. Following his talk entitled, Whatever Happened to Japan, the Economic Superpower That Never Was, Dr. Dunscombe responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked, are there provinces in Japan like our states? Are there red and blue states?
In many ways, the divide has tended to be very much kind of urban versus rural. That is, rural districts have tended to be very much bastions of LDP support, primarily because the infrastructure to maintain LDP support, like the postal system and pork barrel projects and various other things, have really tended to be very strong in those areas. And therefore, the opposition, the Japan Socialist Party in, during the 1980s, was very much sort of centered in the cities. With the shift in the proportional representation system, the LDP, and in fact Koizumi was a good example of this, did work very hard to try and capture some of that urban support at the cost of essentially abandoning the countryside in large, to a large extent. So even that kind of reliable LDP rural vote is starting to go away because things in the countryside have gotten very much worse since the reforms, and there's a realization that something has to be done, and if that actually requires voting for an opposition politician, they may have to do that. So in many respects, Japan is not quite uniformly purple, but it's getting closer to that than it ever has been.
It is my impression, another audience member stated, that Japan likes the social safety net characteristic of North America and Europe. One, is that true? And if it is, why is that, since that seems to be part of the modern state?
Well, in particular, a lot of that has tended to play into the fact that the family was sort of considered to be the primary unit responsible for those, sort of managing those sorts of things, including care of the elderly and that sort of stuff. And through large accumulated family savings, it was possible to do that. You could kind of pawn off that portion of the state's obligations onto the citizenry in that way. There are a number of problems that make it impossible to really carry on that model. First of all is the number of Japanese who are running out of savings, and in particular, the younger generations in Japan are not doing a particularly good job. They're becoming somewhat like us in that they are not accruing savings in any real sense. Also, the scale of the need for care in terms of pensions and health care and those sorts of things is growing tremendously as a result of the demographic crisis. Japan already features the largest portion of its population over the age of 65, and that's simply going to increase while the number of young people goes down. And so it's becoming increasingly apparent that something needs to be done about that, but what exactly needs to be done is one of those things upon which there is yet to be really any sort of meaningful consensus.
What is the current status of the real estate market in Tokyo?
First of all, it's important to note that things are bad in Japan, but they're not bad in Japan because of what happened here. It's not like there was another real estate bubble. Prices in Tokyo and actually throughout Japan have kind of steadily declined, reaching kind of more rational levels, and therefore those assets have kind of fully depreciated, and the loss taken on those assets has been kind of wiped off the ledgers of corporations and banks and other financial firms. What's really hurting Japanese banks in the current crisis is the fact that a large portion of their assets is in stocks of companies that are affiliated with the banks. So, for instance, Mitsubishi Fuji UFJ, which is the largest bank in Japan, I believe certainly one of the largest banks in the world, if not the largest, owns a tremendous amount of shares of all of the various Mitsubishi firms, Fuji Heavy Industries, et cetera, et cetera. The stock market in Japan, the Nikkei index, has followed a rather similar path to ours, meaning that it's lost somewhere on the order of 40% of its value since the fall of last year. And that has created shortfalls and problems with assets for all of the major Japanese banks, which they're finding it difficult to deal with.
Next, another audience member who once taught English in Japan said most of his students, like most people in Japan, had studied English for several years. Meanwhile, they had never traveled outside of Japan, and they could not speak English because the system was geared towards translation and writing English. What does this say about Japan's fear of questioning authority, specifically in education?
Yes, well, first of all, it is necessary to admit that, sadly, no people have studied English to a greater extent, but to less effect than Japan. And it is, I think, primarily for the reasons that you note. What they're asked to study about English is grammar, linguistics, those sorts of things, which are part of the college entrance exams in particular, but are not asked especially to do oral presentation. So that's just something that they don't put a great deal of effort into practicing. Whether this necessarily reflects a deference to authority is another question. I would certainly say that, yes, the Japanese education system in particular, and those who avail themselves of it, has really kind of distorted itself in many ways to serve the needs of the college entrance exam, which were seen as being the key ingredient in sort of putting one on kind of that fast track to the Japanese employment system and the salaryman lifestyle. But once again, as an historian, I would say that Japanese actually, should they put their minds to it, have absolutely no question about questioning authority. And indeed, now that social contract appears to have broken down, it's quite possible that the Japanese will begin to seriously question the utility of those sorts of things. And in fact, there are, in various ways, kind of much concern has been brooded about in Japan about the fact that large numbers of Japanese young people are, in fact, basically opting out of the system in many respects, not even bothering to go to school, not bothering to take the college entrance exams, not even really bothering to undertake useful, productive work in the workforce. I mean, they'll work some to keep themselves and walk around money, but they'll continue to live with their parents and not really seek out a career in any. The phenomenon of so-called kind of parasite singles is part of that. So there has been a large percentage of Japanese youth who are increasingly opting out of the system. So you can see that as kind of voting with their feet, I think, to a certain extent.
Last, another audience member asked Dr. Dunscombe, if some sort of a revolution were to happen in Japan, what do you see it looking like if younger people are in fact, quote, opting out of the system, unquote?
Well, one of the interesting things, one of the reasons why I bother studying popular culture in Japan, in particular anime and various programs like that, is because one can see debates going on about, who future Japanese ought to look like, what ought to be kind of the model. And it's become very apparent that many people, and this is sort of coming out in pop culture debates, are looking backwards to especially the Tokugawa period, the Edo period, as a kind of usable past. So what were we like back then? What are the qualities that we had? And should we try and revive some of these qualities? And of course, one of the things about building a usable past is you kind of pick and choose your qualities. So the best exemplar of that is a 2004 anime show called Samurai Champloo. Champloo is a word for a Ryukyuan sort of stew, which kind of recycles otherwise very hoary and basic samurai chanbara stories, samurai tales, and filters it through the ethos of American rap and hip-hop, with the basic idea that Japanese aren't just, conformist consumers. They are people who are impatient with authority and who want to build their own destiny. And, if we were alike, if we were more like them, we would have a better society. So in many respects, what I hope to see, you know, there's no guarantee, but what I would very much like to see in Japan is a new version of Japanese-ness which realizes that one can be, one can invent oneself, one does not have to defer necessarily to authority, one has the ability to actualize change, and that one can, you know, dare to be something other than what society might necessarily tell you to be. And in fact, one of the things that we often forget, especially looking at contemporary Japan, is that the Japanese have proven, historically, to have quite a capacity for reinvention in that way. One merely needs to look back 150 years to the changes that took place at the end of the Tokugawa period, and then, of course, the Meiji transformation, when Japanese reinvented themselves as modern people. So that capacity exists in the Japanese. And there's a certain casting about to find examples of that that we might be, that Japanese might be able to follow in making that transition. So thank you very much for your question.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Dr. Paul Dunscombe, Professor of East Asian History at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk entitled Whatever Happened to Japan, the Economic Superpower That Never Was, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on Friday, May 15, 2009. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.